Hi, everyone. Dan Cassidy here. Welcome back to our Talking Markets podcast series here on the UBS Market Moves podcast channel. For today's conversation, I'm glad to welcome back from our partners at Invesco, Christina Hooper, joining us right here at our 1285 podcast studio in New York. Christina serves as Chief Global Market Strategist for the firm. Christina, it's great to have you back here on UBS On Air. Thank you for spending some time today with our listeners and our clients.
Thank you so much for having me, Dan. It is always wonderful to participate and be part of anything that UBS is doing.
Thank you, Christina. We're very happy to have you today. So let's jump right into it. Of course, a lot going on in the markets, the macro environment, which we can talk about for our listeners today. It's been a quick start here in 2025, and accounting for recent data, you think about inflation, the labor market. I'm curious, Christina, how would you characterize the current health of the U.S. economy?
Well, I would say that perhaps the best term to use is resilient. We have had a very aggressive tightening cycle between 2022 and 2023, and the U.S. economy has held up far better than I think almost anyone expected. Now, having said that, cracks have formed in the economy. In fact, in the most recent Federal Reserve Beige Book that just came out last week, we heard and saw some community banks and nonprofit organizations report delinquencies are increasing. Lower income Americans are under pressure. And I think it's clear that that's actually been the case for some time, first because of inflation and now because of some of the aggressive tightening has made its way and impacted them as well. So we are at a crossroads where I think the most likely scenario is that the economy continues to slow very modestly and then reaccelerates. But I think certainly there is the potential for the economy to deteriorate more, that the lagged effects of monetary policy haven't fully caught up with us, and that what is weakness in lower income Americans could extend into the middle class more broadly. That is certainly not my base case. My base case is that this economy will continue to be resilient, that it will reaccelerate, but I think we have to watch very carefully what happens. A lot will hinge on the labor market and unemployment. And that's why it is so important to follow that particular measure.
Now, another factor which could impact the evolution of the U.S. economy this year, we do have a new administration in place in the White House. We're recording here on January 23rd. So I'm curious, based on some of the mandates, priorities of the Trump administration, how might that impact the economy's trajectory from here, Christina?
So when I think about kind of the key policies coming from the Trump administration, I think almost of a balance sheet where you have assets and liabilities, or maybe it's easier to think of them as pro-growth and potentially problematic. And in the pro-growth category, I have, of course, deregulation. That can be very, very powerful in terms of not just positively impacting the economy, but also impacting sentiment. In fact, we've seen a really big jump already in small business optimism. And I think that continues. That can unleash animal spirits, not just in markets, but in the economy. And of course, the impact can already happen, as we've seen. So it's something that is immediate. Now, tax cuts are also positive. They can be very stimulative. The timing is a little longer on that, of course, but it does not mean that it is not, in fact, important. So that is part of what I think are the most important pro-growth policies. On the other side of the balance sheet, of course, is tariffs and immigration. We know, just based on 2018 and what we saw with the first Trump administration, that tariffs can create headwinds. They can create volatility for the stock market. In fact, we saw the S&P 500 down about 5% in 2018 with a lot of volatility. And we also saw that it had an impact, albeit temporary, on prices. And it depressed business investment because it ratcheted up uncertainty. So that can create headwinds, but a lot of it has to do with the timing and the scale of tariffs. So if we were to see 60% tariffs on China, and long-lasting, not threatened, but in fact put in place and there for a long time, that could be problematic. Whereas something brief or even just threatened would be a very different story and would have far less impact. And that would be far less impact on the economy, but also far less impact on markets. Immigration, I think it really depends on what we get in terms of immigration policy. If it is deportation of people who have committed crimes, that is not going to have an impact on the economy. In fact, it could be positive. But if we were to have mass deportations, that could be very problematic. And in fact, I think of that as the far greater risk in terms of inflation. Because we already have a tight labor market, especially in certain industries and the services industries, many of them do rely on some illegal labor. And so you could see a real tightening there. And that is price increases that, unlike tariffs, are sustainable. Deportation is very different than taking on and pulling off tariffs. Mm-hmm. So that's how I think about the policies. I'm very excited about that, which can be pro-growth. And I think there's a lot of uncertainty around exactly what we're going to get with tariffs and immigration. We just have to follow it closely.
Well, a lot of considerations there when it comes to potential policy developments out of Washington. So we will see what comes out of the White House in the weeks and months ahead. You did mention the Fed a bit earlier, Christina. It appears that Chairman Powell will remain in his seat for now. We're coming off of 100 basis points worth of cuts in 2024. As we look ahead, what do you expect in the way of the road ahead for monetary policy in 2025?
Well, Dan, that is perhaps the $64,000 question. We've seen just in the last few months a big change in expectations around what the Fed will do in 2025. And a lot of it has to do with concerns that some Trump policies could be inflationary. And that could be even pro-growth policies. That they always, of course, have the potential of also causing inflation to go up. And the Fed has noted that there's just far more uncertainty today than there was before. So I think we're going to see a cautious Fed going forward, one that is more than ever going to be data dependent. I don't think we'll see any kind of Fed cut in the first quarter because it wants to be data dependent. It wants to see how these policies play out and impact the economy. But also, I think the Fed hasn't seen much progress recently. And we know that the Fed, when we go through a quarter where there's not much in the way of disinflationary progress, it doesn't want to act. But in a quarter when you see a lot of progress, then as follow-up, as we saw last September, they will want to act. So I think this is going to be very much touch and go. I wouldn't anticipate any cut until the second quarter at the earliest. But I think at the end of the day, disinflation does continue. And that monetary policy where it is today is quite restrictive. For example, if we look at the gap between core PCE and the Fed funds rate, it is still wide. It is still higher than what we've seen historically in the last, say, two decades. So that tells me that there is room for the Fed to cut unless it becomes very, very concerned about a resurgence in inflation. Now, of course, the Fed is very attuned to that risk. No one wants to be another Arthur Burns. Mm. It's interesting. I think they'd rather be Herbert Hoover than Arthur Burns. That to me means they're going to be more reluctant to cut. But I still think at the end of the day, they will cut and we'll get a few cuts this year by the time 2025 is over.
I believe the first meeting is next week on the 28th and 29th. So it will be interesting to hear from the chairman at that 2 p.m. press conference next Wednesday, what they're thinking and what the path forward might look like. Turning to thematics, Christina, what excites you at the moment here at UBS at our chief investment office? Artificial intelligence comes to mind. We've been talking a lot about the energy transition, but any themes in particular that jump out to you at the moment?
So absolutely AI. It has legs. What we're seeing is that companies continue to plan on investing, putting significant resources into AI. What we've gleaned from a number of earnings calls over the last few quarters is that companies believe the risk of not investing in AI is greater than the risk of over-investing in AI. And they're actually seeing some ancillary benefits from investing in terms of upgraded technological infrastructure. So I think that story continues. That is not a one-trick pony. And in fact, there are far more beneficiaries than what we would originally consider to be kind of the key AI plays. I think that extends to areas like utilities. That extends to companies that are simply using AI to be more efficient and more productive. So I think we see the net spread in terms of the opportunities created by AI in 2025. Another theme that I'm really excited about is cybersecurity. When we look at the lists of the top 10 concerns or risks that CEOs around the country, but also in many other countries around the world, articulate, typically the top three risks is cybersecurity. There's enormous headline reputational risk that comes along with data breaches and other cybersecurity-related pitfalls. And so I think we're likely to continue to see significant investment in cybersecurity going forward. And I think that, of course, creates a number of investing opportunities as well.
So before we get into your allocation preferences, what you like at the moment, just sticking with risks for a moment, outside of what you might have already covered, anything else in the way of risks, headwinds, top of mind?
Sure. Fiscal deficits. And they can really impact the economy and markets in two different ways. So first of all, let me make the case for why I'm concerned about fiscal deficits. They're becoming a problem in more and more countries. In fact, a lot of the geopolitical turmoil we've seen over the last several months has been related to budget deficits and budget agreements for next year. For example, Canada, Justin Trudeau, one of his issues, probably the biggest issue that caused ultimately his resignation as leader of his party, was infighting with Chrystia Freeland. A lot of it was around the budget deficit and the budget for 2025. Similarly, what we're seeing is in France, in Germany, discussions about exactly what the budget will be like, how to manage fiscal deficits, how to meet the EU's new rules on what they want to see in terms of caps on deficits as a percentage of GDP. And of course, we're seeing that in the United States. It has been, the pause button has been hit on it, but we'll come back to it. And of course, there's a very real concern, and we've seen it in yields going up in a number of countries. You can trigger bond vigilantism if you continue to grow fiscal deficits ad nauseum. So I don't think it's a crisis at this point, but it's certainly something that's becoming increasingly concerning. And I think we're just going to see more attention devoted to it, more geopolitical uncertainty created by it, and more risk that we can get to that point where investors are not interested in investing in government bonds because of fiscal deficits. We're not that there yet in the U.S., but our fiscal deficits have grown very significantly. And in fact, that can continue. So what will happen? Well, you know, the most likely scenario is that governments cut spending, if they're lucky to come to agreement on what to cut. So that can create economic headwinds. You have assumptions based on what you think governments will spend. And if they cut that spending, that can create headwinds. So that alters perhaps the scenario on U.S. economic growth, global economic growth. I think the bigger issue, though, of course, is that yields can go higher, and that can be problematic for other asset classes. We know that when the U.S. Treasury yields go up, they tend to put pressure on stocks. So it's certainly something that even if we're not actually bond investors, we need to pay attention to because it does have ramifications for markets in general.
Well, we know D.C. likes to spend money, so definitely something to keep an eye on.
Well, absolutely. And if you think about it, it is awfully hard for us to come to any agreement on what to cut. I mean, if you look at the Simpson-Bowles Commission, very earnest, conscientious, thoughtful, a number of great people on that committee trying to find ways to cut the fiscal deficit. They came up with a set of proposals. I don't think Congress voted into law any of those changes. I don't think they were at all taken into account and made their way into altering our fiscal deficits. There is potential there, but it is hard. What we find is that there are just so many interest groups that want to make sure line items of spending are preserved. At the end of the day, the easiest path, the path of least resistance, is to just lower rates. Mm. So if only the Fed can cooperate, that'll certainly impact the amount of money we spend servicing our debt and, of course, will reduce pressure on our deficits.
Well, perhaps Congress will turn a new leaf in 2025. Time will tell, I suppose.
We'll see, Dan. It's hard.
So if we turn to some positioning views, where you're putting money to work at the moment, we'll take asset areas one at a time, maybe beginning with equities, looking at different sectors, maybe size, style, anything jump out to you at the moment within equities?
Sure. Well, you know, my views are based on our expectations around the economy, the U.S. economy, the global economy, and that is that both modestly slow and then expect a and then I expect a reacceleration this year. So stocks are likely to discount that in advance. What I think we're going to see this year is a scenario where small and mid caps, as well as cyclicals, perform better. They're far more sensitive to the economy. And so if we do see the economy reaccelerate, then that would be a positive for them. And I think would result in a broadening of the stock market. And again, I think it's likely that they at least modestly outperform large caps, especially large cap techs. They'll hold their own. And of course, there are a lot of thematic drivers for large cap tech. But I think we're likely to see cyclicals perform well. You also have that added benefit of far lower valuations. So it's a good diversification tool to add exposure to cyclicals and small and mid caps. When we go outside the U.S., I think there's potential. You know, historically, we've seen Fed easing cycles result in positive years, better years for developed markets, ex-US, for emerging markets. And in fact, we know that with the emerging markets, we didn't get the rate cuts that were anticipated from EM central banks in 2024. I think that could very well happen in 2025. And that could certainly be a catalyst for EM, even if we don't get enough Fed easing to really move the needle for the EM space. Now, we do have to worry about tariffs as headwinds for stocks outside the U.S. What we know from 2018 is that while the S&P 500 took a hit of about 5%, Chinese stocks, for example, took an even bigger hit. And so any stock market in an economy that is the object of tariffs from the U.S. Could experience some volatility, could experience some sell-offs. The key, though, is if it's short-term, then it's likely to have a very short-term effect on those stock markets and could create a buying opportunity.
So there is some historical precedent to draw from when it comes to the potential impacts of tariffs to international equities.
Yes, it tends to be a negative for those countries that have tariffs applied to them. But again, especially if we look at recent history, 2018, it wasn't a long-term issue. And so presumably if tariffs are being used as threats, and I think there's a really good argument to be made that that's what we're going to get from the Trump administration, is using tariffs not as an end goal, but as a means to an end. Mm-hmm. And those are other policy goals. So, for example, threatening tariffs on Mexico if they don't comply with U.S. immigration policies, threatening tariffs on Europe if they don't buy more U.S. energy. So there are these other policy goals that can be achieved by using tariffs. And I think a number of these countries are likely to go to the bargaining table because they know the U.S. means business, given the precedent set in 2018.
So tariffs could be a short-term hiccup if implemented to equity market momentum, so
to speak.
That's
what I think is the most likely scenario.
And then on the fixed income side, it's interesting. Really, since that December Fed meeting, mid-December, we've seen bond yields on the rise. What within fixed income looks attractive to you at the moment, Christina?
So first, I have to lay out my base cases, which is that I don't think yields will go that much farther up. We've already seen an easing somewhat, and of course, that is triggered by the most recent inflation data. It's triggered by Fed speak. But I think in general, we'll see some volatility in the yield, but I don't think it pierces 5%. That's okay. Certainly not what I think is the most likely scenario for 2025. And so that means that we'll see relatively high yields, but I don't think we have an enormous amount of duration risk, but I would be well diversified. I'd have bank loans, enjoy current high yields, which could last for a while, especially if the Fed is slow to ease, but also have some exposure to duration. I think you know, areas that seem to be sweet spots, given how resilient the U.S. economy is investment grade, high yield. I think we also, if we get, an upside scenario where it's an environment in which disinflation occurs more quickly, growth reaccelerates more quickly, that's a time when emerging markets debt looks really attractive. That's a time when risk appetite is likely to grow. Mm-hmm. And so I think we can go further out. But to me, we're not going to get a lot of yield compression, but we are going to enjoy relatively high yields. I think of this almost as, and I don't want to say a golden age of fixed income, but quite frankly, it's a far better environment than we've experienced for many years.
We've covered a lot of ground for our listeners. Before we wrap up, anything you would like to reinforce or any final thoughts, takeaways you would like to leave us with?
Well, one of the questions I get asked a lot is, what keeps you up at night? What do you think is the biggest risk? And I've certainly articulated some risks to the market. But what I think the biggest risk is clients getting spooked and getting out of markets. I think there are always reasons to be afraid and to get out. But you know, many of the risks we've talked about are relatively short-term in nature. And most clients' time horizons are far longer. And in fact, the greatest disservice they can do is get out and not participate. I mean, certainly we want to be well-diversified so we can tolerate the volatility that is likely to come. But we want to have exposure and participate. I hearken back to the global financial crisis. I sat on a small endowment investment committee at the time, and we got into a huge argument over what to do. It was February of 2009, and there were a number of people on the investment committee that couldn't tolerate the sell-off in the stock market and wanted to get out. And if we had done it, we didn't. But if we had done that, we would have just locked in our losses and not participated in the upside. So I think it's really important that we, you know, use investment policy statements as a guide, be well diversified, and to a certain extent, put on blinders. There are going to be a lot of headlines coming out, a lot of policy decisions, a lot of uncertainty. And I think we have to recognize that that is more noise than signal, and that we're in it for the long haul.
So stay invested if there's one
Absolutely.
Takeaway.
Absolutely. You bet.
Christina, always a pleasure. Thank you for spending some time with us today, joining in studio, and do look forward to having you back again soon.
That'd be great. Thank you so much, Tim.
Thank you for tuning in. Be sure to visit ubs.com/studios to view the entire UBS Studios suite of podcast channels, along with our video offerings, such as UBS Trending. You can also follow us on Instagram for content highlights at UBS Trending. UBS Studios is part of the UBS Chief Investment Office within UBS Global Wealth Management. Visit ubs.com/CIO to view the latest research.
As a firm providing wealth management services to clients, UBS Financial Services, Inc. offers investment advisory services in its capacity as an SEC-registered investment advisor and brokerage services in its capacity as an SEC-registered broker-dealer. Investment advisory services and brokerage services are separate and distinct, differ in material ways, and are governed by different laws and separate arrangements. It is important that you understand the ways in which we conduct business and that you carefully read the agreement and disclosures that we provide to you about the products or services we offer. For more information, please review client relationship summary provided at ubs.com/relationship summary or ask your UBS financial advisor for a copy.